The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Welcome to The Christian Outlook, the weekly radio program that sorts through the issues in our fast-changing world in a way that honors your Christian faith. Brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. I'm Calvin McCullough. Great to be with you. This week, a monumental First Amendment case landed before the Supreme Court.
There were many justices that were very concerned about the fact that this was targeting of one particular point of view.
We discuss a student removed from class for daring to note that there are only two genders.
The pinnacle, supposedly, of Western civilization is embarrassing himself by suggesting that we don't even believe in biological facts any longer.
And the lead singer from Mercy Me tells the real story behind the hit movie, I Can Only Imagine.
If he got embarrassed in public, he would, you know, he'd wait and take it out on me. And I don't remember many weeks where I wasn't beaten three or four times a week.
And what changed his father.
He went from being a monster to being a man who was desperately and passionately in love with Jesus.
Thanks for joining us. I'm Calvin McCullough, coming to you from my home station in New York City. AM 570 The Mission and AM 970 The Answer. We'll begin at the Supreme Court. Earlier this week, the High Court began hearing arguments in a California case where the state is requiring pro-life clinics to promote abortion. It sounds absurd, and it is. I spoke with Kevin Terrio, Senior Counsel and Vice President of the Center for Life at Alliance Defending Freedom. Crisis pregnancy centers under state law have been required to put up signs that say, if you want an abortion, here's the phone number, or down the street, or you get the picture. How did it become that way in California?
Well, you've got a lot of hostility towards people who are in favor of protecting life in California, and the abortion lobby got them to pass a law that targeted pregnancy centers, singled them out for special a special type of law that requires them to not only refer for abortion, but even if they don't provide any medical services at all, to do an ad that a disclaimer that basically prohibits them from doing any kind of advertising. It's completely egregious and very obvious that this law was targeted against these pro-life centers.
Sure. So let's talk court strategy a little bit, because we won't know what the justices decide for several weeks. But the arguments are being made on constitutional grounds. Where is this law the weakest?
Well, it's the weakest because it compels speech, and it compels it in an area where people are advocating for a particular point of view. So these pregnancy centers, they are there to help women, but they do it from a pro-life perspective to empower them to be able to choose to have their baby. Oftentimes they go to other pregnancy providers or pregnancy folks who do pregnancy counseling, and all they get is the abortion option in certain circumstances. But that's not what our centers do. They give them not only information about how to choose life, but they also support them with before the baby's born and after
right.
the baby's born.
No, I get the whole crisis pregnancy operation thing. We talk a lot about that on the show, actually. But what I'm curious about is, in the before the justices, the argument that the lawyer makes is it's an infringement of First Amendment speech. Is there any commerce connection to the argument?
There's really not. It's all about forcing an organization that's religious based to say a message that completely contradicts
right.
what they believe.
So it's speech
that's
and faith. It's
yeah.
speech and faith then. Okay.
No, sure.
Let me ask you this. With the new Supreme Court justice there, Gorsuch, are you optimistic that this is the right season to get this argument before the court?
Absolutely. Justice Gorsuch, along with certainly some of the other justices that are considered more conservative, Justice Alito and Justice Roberts and certainly Justice Thomas and even Justice Kennedy, are very pro-free speech. But, you know, some of the other justices that sometimes lean to the left are also very pro-free speech. And so we're very optimistic that Justice Kagan Justice Breyer will be very sympathetic to this argument, and possibly even Justices Ginsburg and Justice Sotomayor.
Now, see, this is going to really blow people's minds, but I was actually discussing this with other people today, and I said, I think this could be a big win, a 6-3, 7-2, maybe even a 9-0, because of what you just mentioned. Some of those other left-leaning justices very much side with the free speech argument, and while a lot of pro-abortion people think, well, if you're choice, you're going to automatically be for our side, they may have really overplayed a hand here, did they not?
I really think they did. There were many justices that were very concerned about the fact that this was targeting of one particular point of view, singling them out and saying you have to speak in a way that you don't want to because of your pro-life views. And that's very disturbing to all the justices.
I'm old enough to remember when college campuses were all about freedom of speech. Honestly, it wasn't that long ago. But in a few short years, the script has flipped completely. Like a six-year-old who resorts to shoving when arguments don't work, professors have become word police. They decide what is and isn't free speech in the classroom and on the campuses. And in this latest absurdity, science is the victim of the politically correct. KKLA's Frank Sontag spoke with Dr. Everett Piper, the president of Oklahoma Wesleyan University.
Who is Lake Ingle? And talk about how he was banned from a Christian theology class of all things.
Lake Ingle is a senior at Indiana University in Pennsylvania. His major is religious studies. One of the required classes for him to graduate is Christianity 481. He was taking that class this semester, at which time his professor started talking about the variety of genders, that there are multiple genders. Lake raised his hand and said, "Excuse me, I think there are only two, and most biologists would agree with me." The professor kicked him out of class, not just for that session, but for the entire semester, therefore kicked him out of a class that he needs to graduate from the university.
Dr. Piper, a man that's president of Oklahoma Wesleyan University, and obviously you stand firm on God's truth, what went through your mind when you found out Lake Ingle, a young man pursuing Christian theology, was kicked out because he said there are only two genders?
Well, frankly, I'm embarrassed for my industry, Frank. This is lunacy. The ivory tower, higher education, the college, the university, the pinnacle, supposedly, of Western civilization, is embarrassing itself by suggesting that we don't even believe in biological facts any longer. We are being so misogynistic as to suggest that women aren't real, that a woman is nothing but a fabrication and a fantasy of a dysphoric male who wants to raise his hand on a given day and pretend he's a female. How misogynistic can you be? What is more insulting to a human being than to suggest that they don't even really exist? And we're the ones that are accused, conservatives are the ones that are accused of being anti-science. Well, excuse me, what science is there out there that will tell you that there are multiple genders? Any biologist, any physiologist, any geneticist will agree that there are two genders, male and female, and except for any anomalies, which is called a hermaphrodite. This is a fact. The facts are that there are two genders, and I don't have to be a Christian or a conservative to come to that conclusion. I can be an empirically based scientist to draw that conclusion. But no, we've got ideological fascism running rampant in the college and university campus today, rather than academic freedom and intellectual liberty. You must submit, you must comply with this lunacy, otherwise you're verboten and you're actually expelled from class.
Dr. Everett Piper is my guest. Everett, am I correct that Lake Ingle was also kicked out of class because he questioned what seems to be something that is very misunderstood? In fact, I think Forbes magazine clearly said that the gender pay gap, he said, wait a minute. He also pointed out it's not exactly the way it's being reported. And his teacher also, the feminist professor, booted him out for that as well.
That's a part of the story I don't know. So you know more than I do, but I'll comment on it and I'll say this. So what? If he did question that and he wanted to debate that, isn't that what the classroom is for? Isn't that the very definition of a good, robust exchange of ideas where we actually have a debate and decide who's right and who's wrong? It goes back to the subtitle of my book. The devastating consequences of abandoning truth is that power always wins. And who had power in this case? The professor. She shut down the debate and she expelled the kid because he had a contrary view.
What did she kick him out for? What did she say her reason was?
Well, as I understand it, the reason is that he's being intolerant. Okay? Now, stop and think about this. She can't tolerate his intolerance. It's self-refuting. You're cutting off the very branch upon which you set to say you can't tolerate my intolerance, or you hate hateful people, or you're sure that nothing is sure, and you're absolutely confident there are no absolutes. This makes no sense. And again, it all digresses to power if you get rid of the principles of truth. If there's no referee to judge the game, to blow the whistle on the game, then you can't play any longer. It's chaos. You can't play soccer. You can't play basketball without some rules and some boundaries and a referee to define who's playing the game and who's cheating. And in this case, it all digresses to power within the classroom, because you can't engage in academic learning if there's no free and open exchange of ideas.
Dr. Piper, I want to read you the actual reason why this occurred, and then your comments. After showing a 15-minute TED Talk by transgender ex-pastor Paula Stone Williams discussing the reality of mansplaining, sexism from men, and male privilege, the professor, in this case Allison Downey, asked the women in the class to share their thoughts. No women in the class said anything. That's when Lake Engle spoke up and basically said, "I'm not so sure I agree with you." Now, this is a Christian theology class of all things.
Well, keep in mind, it's at a state university, so the definition of Christian theology at Indiana University in Pennsylvania is probably very, very different than the definition of Christian theology at Oklahoma Wesleyan University. In other words, I would suggest that they're probably deconstructing Christianity and building it up in their own image, or it's a critical review of Christianity rather than an affirming one. I don't know that for a fact, but I'm probably right. Yep. So when he wanted to discuss this issue within an orthodox fashion, he was unwelcome, because that wasn't the direction the professor wanted to go.
Speak to, and obviously he's not here to share his version, but for a young man in the case of Lake Engle to stand up, be banned from class, and yet some of his quotes I'm reading, he says, "It's my firmest belief that every human being has the freedom and right to identify, dress, represent oneself as they see fit." But he says, "I think this is all an attempt to silence my views personally because they contradict the ones, for instance, my professor in class so evidently pushes." This man's courageous.
He is courageous. And stop and think about any 20, 21-year-old kid that actually has the spine or the courage to say what he just said. That's very rare. I've told parents over and over again, if you think that it's a cakewalk for your kids today in these universities that teach this pablum, you need to wake up, because this is what they're being confronted with day in and day out. You just don't hear about it very often, because most of them are silent and they cower in the corner because they're afraid of getting a bad grade and getting expelled. And the proof is in this story. When they do speak up, it often happens accordingly. They get punished.
Coming up.
If he got embarrassed in public, he would, you know, he'd wait and take it out on me. And I don't remember many weeks where I wasn't beaten 3 or 4 times a week.
The incredible story that led to the song and movie, I Can Only Imagine, when the Christian Outlook returns in a moment. Welcome back to the Christian Outlook. I'm Kevin McCullough. To hear this show again in its entirety, go to ChristianOutlook.com. While you're there, take a moment to sign up for the podcast. Last weekend, Hollywood was shocked by the number of people who went to see the faith-based film, I Can Only Imagine. Given the limited release, people were expecting the movie to do between $2 and $4 million in its opening weekend. It grossed over $17 million. The film is based on a true story. Salem host Eric Metaxas spoke with Bart Millard, the man the movie is based on.
For people who don't know what kind of a hit this was, the movie is your story.
Right.
It's the story of you growing up and your father and all this stuff and how you came to write songs. So again, for people who know nothing about it, what is that story that led you to write this blockbuster of a song?
Well, my parents divorced when I was 3, and my mom remarried when I was in third grade, and my stepdad was transferred from Greenville, Texas, outside of Dallas, to San Antonio, and for whatever reason, all of my family lived in Greenville. It was a real small town. Everybody lived there. When my mom moved away, it was kind of like by committee, everybody decided that my brother and I should stay in the same school with the rest of our family, let mom figure out what's going on because, you know, I don't know. And so I ended up living with my dad from about third grade on. And my dad was incredibly abusive, but nobody really knew. My brother never knew the extent of it until we were both adults, because apparently it was more towards me. If he had a bad day, he would take it out on me. He never drank, no substance abuse, just had an awful temper. And if he got embarrassed in public, he would, you know, he'd wait and take it out on me. And I don't remember many weeks where I wasn't beaten three or four times a week. And this went on until probably my freshman year in high school, when my dad was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer. Everything changed. He had it from my freshman year in high school to my freshman year in college. And in that 4 or 5 year period, somehow the gospel changed him. He went from being a monster to being a man who was desperately and passionately in love with Jesus. And literally, by the time he passed away, he was the godliest man I'd ever known.
Yeah. That wasn't clear to me that it was that dramatic.
Yeah, it affected me so much. It's really the reason I'm in ministry now, is because, you know, I had a front row seat to see the one guy I did not think the gospel could change would be my dad. And not only to change him, but to literally be my hero. Like, the only time I got mad at God wasn't when I was being abused. It's when I had the dad I always wanted and then he left. He passed away. And he was a big deal to me in my life.
Well, I mean, stories like this, at the very least, give everybody hope. Hmm. Because when you describe this man, and obviously in the movie, Dennis Quaid, I had the privilege of interviewing Dennis Quaid at NRB recently, and the character that he plays in the film, your dad, it's so dark. Mm-hmm. Now, I have to say, many people know that as that's just real life. Like, right. There's a lot of abuse, a lot of dark stuff in families that you don't see when everybody's in church.
Sure.
You know, people don't see my dark side. Mm-hmm. That's kind of real life, you know, dealing with these demons, with these passions, with anger. A lot of times it's righteous anger. In other words, like, you get angry and you're angry because something went wrong, or because the kids didn't listen, or didn't. So then the question is, what do you do with that? And so you're describing a situation where it clearly got out of hand.
Yeah. And, you know, that was the big deal with this movie too, was when we were first approached about the movie, I didn't want it to be like a low hanging fruit, or just kind of this kind of fluffy Christian film, if you will. No disrespect to any other movies, but I was like, man, I was worried that they wouldn't be able to show how bad he was, because it might water down the redemption story.
That's right. Well, look, this is the classic problem with, like, quote unquote Christian art.
Right.
Dostoevsky didn't have this problem.
Right.
But my contemporary Christian sensibility sometimes veer toward the saccharine.
Sure.
And if the darkness isn't really dark, then what are we being saved from?
Yeah,
you know,
absolutely.
If you're kind of like, anyway, so, but your stuff was really dark. I mean, there's this scene early in the movie where your father, played by Dennis Quaid, kind of, you know, explodes and, like, cracks a plate over your head. Mm-hmm. And I just, watching that, I mean, I didn't grow up with that, but I also recognize that is real life for a lot of people. I mean, we're all dealing with stuff. And in certain places, it just goes there.
Yeah.
And then you think, well, what do you do with this? What do you do with a man who is so tortured? So I guess my question is, how did that man become a Christian? What was it that led him to faith?
Well, I mean, I probably didn't know until, and it kind of talks about it in the movie too. It was, there's a couple of things. One, my dad never remarried, but he dated this woman named Jerry from, like, when I was probably seventh grade until he passed away. She was a godly woman. I think they would have gotten married, but he was diagnosed with cancer like a year or so into it. And he thought, oh, I'm not going to marry you. I have cancer. Why would I do that to you? And so he thought, I guess for some reason, her going home alone after he passed away was better than having her in the house with us. But anyway, but she was always around, and she was a huge influence on him. And then, you know, I found out later, I used to, when I had to get out of football and join choir because of an injury, I had an amazing teacher that kind of showed me that I'd had a gift, and I started singing in church, and it was always broadcast on, like, a local radio station. And my dad told me, like, you know, not long before he passed away, that, you know, he would always listen to me, because we used to go to church when I was real little, but then between depression of a divorce and then just when the cancer hit, he was done with church. And then I got super involved with the youth group, and I think he was almost jealous of that. And so he wasn't a big fan. And but he told me later on, he's like, every time you would sing, I would listen. I would keep listening to the pastors and preachers and teach and stuff. And a lot of things he started trying to figure out himself, like reading the Bible from cover to cover and not understanding it. And
so even with this violent rage, he was trying.
Yeah, when he was diagnosed, something changed. And, I don't know if it's because, death was inevitable. I don't know what it was about him, but I think he wanted to make things right as much as he possibly could. And I remember I would hear him pray in the other room, and we'd never prayed at Christmas over dinner or anything. And he'd pray over my brother and my mom. We divorced when I was three. Or then at night he would fall asleep with his face in the Word, and I didn't even know we owned a Bible in the house. And, it's like I didn't want grace to be for him for a long time. Like, I was hurt and I didn't trust him, and it almost felt like it was an easy out for what he did to me. And
I was going to say that sense of injustice that so many people are dealing with. That, I mean, look, it's the ultimate issue of forgiveness.
Yeah,
you're asking the right question. Mm. How can I forgive that?
Right.
Like, what do you mean forgive that? I want payback. I want him to see what he did wrong. You know, like. That in many ways, that comes from a good place.
Yeah.
It goes to a bad place. It can go to a bad place. Yeah. But anybody who's angry at somebody, you understand that, God wants to bless you with forgiveness. But of course, that's the whole point, is he understands the grievousness of what you've been through.
Yeah. And that's reflected in the movie as well. There's a moment where it's like, I'm going to go home and forgive my dad. And you're waiting for this big, mountaintop moment. And when I get back and see that he's already changing, like, for the better, I was angry. Because I was supposed to be a savior. I was supposed to be the one to, how dare him change without me being around?
Wow.
Like, and so a lot of people have seen the movie. You're like, I didn't see that coming. You're supposed to, this is where, Rise Again by Dallas Home plays and everybody hugs or whatever. And it's like, no, that was a part of it that it took time because I didn't trust that it was real. And how dare someone else get to him before I did? I really thought I was supposed to be his knight in shining armor.
Our program is coming to you today in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. It's a unique graduate program impacting policy decisions today, preparing public leaders for tomorrow. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. To hear the rest of this amazing conversation, go to christianoutlook.com and go enjoy the movie this weekend. Coming up, a former environmentalist comes clean.
Once you start questioning, once you allow debate, the whole narrative falls apart.
The Christian Outlook returns in a moment.
Ho, 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 ho. Hey.
Ole, 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 ole.
Welcome back to The Christian Outlook. I'm Kevin McCullough. Mark Morano was once your typical environmentalist with one twist. He was seeking truth, not an agenda. And his pursuit of that truth changed his world. He is now the author of the book, The Politically Incorrect Guide to Climate Change. And he spoke with Georgine Rice on KBDQ in Portland, Oregon.
What compels you to challenge the what we are all led to believe is the consensus on climate change, to be so vociferous and to insist that both sides of this this argument be considered?
Well, I've been at this for years now. I actually started out as an environmentalist. And when I realized that I'd been essentially conned about the Amazon rainforest deforestation scare, it turns out it was the most intact forest. I actually did a documentary on that that came out in the year 2000, and I profiled all the celebrities. That was the big environmental issue before global warming. So what happened was, when global warming, I started studying that, I was very skeptical to begin with and grew even more skeptical. And in the book, The Politically Incorrect Guide to Climate Change, I actually lay out all the reasons in there why people should be skeptical, including the UN's own admission that climate policy has nothing to do with the environment or climate. And I realized all these scientists were being intimidated, bullied, careers destroyed. So I found, essentially started working for the United States Senate Environment and Public Works Committee. I was a researcher and the communication director, and it became a lightning rod, the office, because we did a report of 400 dissenting scientists. And since that time on, this became sort of my main interest, because I was trying to speak with and work with the scientists who were dissenting and give them a voice in the media. And that's what I've been trying to do. And that's what I hope this book does, because I profile scientists who used to work for the UN, who turned against the UN, even current UN lead authors, who talk about how it's a political, not scientific process when they issue these big UN climate reports.
Now, you describe yourself as an environmentalist then. You still describe yourself as an environmentalist. And the presumption is that if you oppose climate change, whatever that's supposed to mean today, that you cannot be an environmentalist, because there's only one legitimate view that must be ascribed to in order to wear that moniker.
Yes. In fact, actually, back in the early 90s, Al Gore was saying nearly all scientists agreed. They were trying to create a talking point years ago, decades ago, because they didn't want any dissent. They knew that dissent was fatal to their agenda. And as you go forward here, they have to have conformity, because once you start questioning, once you allow debate, the whole narrative falls apart. And so there's a whole chapter in the book on the United Nations scandal of ClimateGate. And I go through and I show how top United Nations scientists colluded with each other to craft a narrative, much like a political campaign would have a narrative of the candidate and a PR. And they didn't want anything getting in the way. So they threatened scientific journal editors not to publish papers that disagreed with the UN. They threatened and intimidated and bullied other scientists to be silent if they disagreed. And they crafted a narrative without even the consent of the fellow scientists at the UN. And the way the UN process was set up, that the reports that they would issue, that the media would declare dire and end of the world. And as Brian Williams once said, this is the life as we know it is at stake. The fundamental things that keep life going are at stake. It turns out these scientific reports and quotes have to be done line by line, reviewed by UN bureaucrats and politicians. And this is as far from a scientific process as you can imagine.
Let's talk about climate policies and the impact they're having on the world's poor, something that isn't often talked about.
Yes. In the book, I detail about 1.1 billion people don't have running water and electricity. This is an interesting fact, because as we go forward, the United Nations almost wants to celebrate that. And I show that there's a thing called the Climate Fund, the UN Climate Fund. And I interviewed South African development activists in the book, and they explained that the climate money from the UN is going to go to basically the best third world dictators and other leaders who are best able to keep people locked in poverty. In other words, the people without running water, living at a subsistence level with high infant mortality, short life expectancy, are defined by the United Nations as living earth-friendly, and therefore their governments get money essentially to keep them poor because they're doing it the right way. I interview California Governor Jerry Brown in the book, and he actually says that the developing world, Africa, South America, Asia, can't emulate United States prosperity because we need about another 15 to 20 Earths in order for them to do it. So you have white wealthy Westerners telling people of color that they can't develop the way we did. So they're essentially condemning people to a life of poverty. And in the book, I have a little noticed event that Al Gore attended with Bill Gates. And he actually said at the event that Africa is projected to have the biggest population increases in the future, and that population is one of the biggest problems when it comes to global warming. So his solution was to have ubiquitous fertility management. In the book, you will read Al Gore lamenting, a white wealthy Western politician and Al Gore lamenting that there are too many Africans projected in the future, and therefore we need to have fertility management in order to keep their numbers down. Now, any other politician, if you were not a man of the left or the environmental left in particular, could not get away with that kind of implication.
Coming up,
Christians are largely, in terms of sexual activity, promiscuity, not trending too differently from the world, unless you look at very specific indicators.
The Christian Outlook returns in a moment. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Christian Outlook. I'm Kevin McCullough. Parents with teenagers or college students are dealing with a world where promiscuity is assumed. For Christian parents, this is a great frustration. And to be honest, many parents have simply, sadly, given up the battle. Lisa Anderson is the director of young adults at Focus on the Family. She joined Let's Talk with Mark Elstrand in Chicago, Illinois.
Okay, so I see this article in the Christian Post. John Piper defends Francis Chan. Are Christians delaying marriage because they're already having sex? And within this, apparently Francis Chan said, I believe that at least 90% of those who are postponing marriage are already sleeping together, so they don't really see a big need to rush. There is no sense if I want to get married to really consummate this. And then he went on to say there's so much immorality in the church, it's disgusting. And he got challenged on this. I saw that and I went, I wonder what Lisa Anderson knows about this.
Well, two things are true. One is, you know, Francis Chan is always going to put it out there, and he's going to not mince words, that's for sure, nor is John Piper.
Right.
But yeah, a young woman decided to kind of challenge them. And I say, you know, I've been asked, well, Lisa, what do you think? And I say, well, I kind of believe both sides. So basically, she's coming after him saying, look, hold the phone. There are a lot of Christian singles out there that are still holding the line, that are committed to sexual purity before marriage, in marriage, that really want to honor God in their choices. And so she's saying, don't lump us in with the rest of the culture. I'm not sure where Chan got his 90% metric, but, you know, whatever. I mean, the fact is, what he and Piper are saying is sadly very true, and that has infiltrated the church. Christians are largely, in terms of sexual activity promiscuity, not trending too differently from the world unless you look at very specific indicators. And so this young woman is really, you know, calling him to account and saying, okay, but we're out here. We're out here. Don't lump us in with everyone else, because we're really trying to stay biblically true. And let me tell you, and I agree with her, it is tough. And we are painted into a corner, and whether in the church or in the culture, single young adults who want to save sex for marriage are viewed kind of as freaks, and it really takes a lot of courage to take a stand today.
Okay, well, let's come back to what Francis Chan was saying just for a moment, because do you see the amount of activity like he's talking about, you know, with premarital involvement increasing from, say, 10 years ago or 15 years ago? I mean, having couples always kind of struggled, and we went through the 70s, you know, and a lot of free love was going on in the late 60s, early 70s. So, again, I'm not sure. Is it much worse today?
I would say percentage-wise, probably, and that is because the average marrying age is going up. So, for example, where in the late 60s, early 70s, you saw couples marrying at 22 and 20 for males and females, respectively, now we're looking at 29 and 27. So, in the meantime, as Chan and Piper are saying, yeah, they're just kind of throwing in the towel and saying, well, this is ridiculous if I'm going to remain a virgin until I'm 30. So, but I don't really want to do marriage yet, so I'm going to practice at it. I'm probably going to live with my partner. And so that's where you see just kind of the overwhelming acceptance of the practice, whereas before it was much more fringe and much more not seen as a precursor to marriage, whereas today it is.
Okay, so Caitlin raises this point, and I know you and I have touched on this before, but I always like to hear you comment on it as a single woman. Yet there seems to be so few unmarried Christian men around interested in pursuing any of these women to get married. I mean, does she raise a good point?
She does. And it's not that there aren't men out there. I mean, hey, guys, hi. But I think if you look in your evangelical churches, if you look in the standard places where people tell us to look, you know, go to your singles group, go to a small group, go to the men aren't there. And so we really have to see the Christian men kind of coming out of the woodwork, choosing to not only attend church, but get involved in church at this point. And, you know, I think statistically, it depends on what generation you're in. I mean, your best time to meet someone who's like-minded, heading in the same direction, loves Jesus, has their head on straight, is in your early 20s, beginning in college and moving in through that first decade, because it really becomes difficult, and the exponential level of brokenness, you know, elevates the older you get.
Hmm. Well, Lisa, she brought up another interesting point, and I'd have to say, you know, yeah, I think it may be different today. The cost of college. And she said that working off that student loan debt and having to work multiple jobs is also one of the reasons why young people have little time for socialization. Does she raise a good point here?
I think that can play into it, too. I think there are a number of factors, Mark, that have contributed to why millennials in particular are marrying later. There is a fear of marriage based on the examples they've seen in their own parents. There is, exactly as Caitlin said, school debt, and it's snowballed, and millennials are saddled with more of it than any other generation. But I always counter that by saying, well, who said you can't marry poor? You know, I mean, my parents did it, and, and they lived on orange crates and ate eggs for 3 months. But I think there's this idea now that millennials have inherited from the relatively wealthy, you know, boomer generation that, oh, we can't get married until all debt is paid off, until we can buy a Georgian home with Ethan Allen furniture in it, you know, and have all the luxuries that our parents do. And that's just false. You can get married and kind of work together to pay off that debt and shoulder it, which is actually an easier proposition than doing it alone.
Okay, so if we know these conditions exist in the culture, what can the church do, and especially those who lead singles ministries, to kind of help nurture this idea that, you know, relationships are really important and marriage is really important within the Christian community? How can we encourage that mindset to be restored?
Well, I think the first thing churches have to do is really elevate marriage, and not to the exclusion of the value of singleness. You know, I say that you're not in a second-class status as a single. Singleness isn't a waiting room for marriage. You're not just going to sit around twiddling your thumbs, hoping for someone to come along. But at the same time, some of the worst narratives that I've heard about marriage have been from within the church. And so we need to talk about it as God's design, that it is God's plan for most people. And what does that look like to have a healthy, not perfect, but healthy marriage within the church? The next thing they need to do is start bringing the purity talks towards the 20 and 30-something. So you had them at 14 years old in youth group, and then all of a sudden now, as young adults enter their 20s, they're just hearing cricket, when this is exactly the time that they need to be told a good biblical sexual ethic, because they are now away from their family of origin, most likely. They're in their own apartments. They're making their own choices. So we need to understand a biblical worldview of sexuality, of marriage, of relationship, get that squared away, preach it in the churches, in the pulpits, and model it in the families throughout the church so that single young adults can see that and know that it's not only good, but that it's attainable.
Our program is coming to you today in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy, where they are preparing leaders for the public square. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. Coming up, the bizarre world of microaggressions continues.
Think about the people who are overhearing God bless you in a library and are not Christian. We really have to think about those people's feelings when we're addressing this matter, and it's a serious concern.
The Christian Outlook returns in a moment. Welcome back to The Christian Outlook. I'm Kevin McCullough. Are you oppressing your fellow man? Why, yes. Yes, you are, according to the far left. And there's simply no way to avoid it short of moving off the grid by yourself and living off the land. Here with the latest is Salem host Frank Sontag, my colleague on KKLA in Los Angeles.
There is a college in Boston. It is called Simon's College. And according to what is called, quote, anti-oppression library guide, end quote, which is written by a group of librarians, it says, God bless you after someone sneezes is a microaggression against Muslim people.
Well, I think it is, because it's a reasserting Christian dominance, or the Christian patriarchy, and all these ridiculous concepts that by asserting God bless you instead of Allah bless you or the Great Spirit bless you or whatever, that it's somehow reasserting Christian dominance and Christian normativity over people who are religious minorities. Thus, it's the majority oppressing the minority groups. And that's why they don't like it. Even though God bless you is a kind gesture of saying that, like, if you sneeze, it's like, God bless you, we want you to get better. It's just a polite gesture. It's not anything rude or asserting any nefarious practice. But in the day and age that we live in, just because it's saying God and it's, you know, it's politically incorrect, that we have to get rid of it now.
So if you're thinking, what? There's a little more.
Killings and stuff are pale in comparison to saying God bless you. You have to really realize how indignant, how hurt people are when they hear that term. I mean, yeah, you might be persecuted in China, but think about the people who are overhearing God bless you in a library and are not Christian. We really have to think about those people's feelings when we're addressing this matter, and it's a serious concern.
This is not satire. This is really going on. You have to ask yourself, God bless you. Wouldn't that be offensive to atheists? Not Muslims? I mean, they believe in a God, right? So That's kind of bizarre to me, number one. Number two, it's really more of how many people that are non-believers say God bless you? And the truth of the matter is they don't even think twice about it, right? It's just impulsive. It's reflexive. I'm not sure what that has to do with much of anything. Maybe we need to take the group of librarians to lunch and treat them to a free lunch. Maybe they've just been in the books a little too long, that they've formed this anti-oppression library guide.
That wraps up this edition of the Christian Outlook. Remember to subscribe to our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and Google Play, and never miss these and other great conversations. Thank you for joining us today. Our program has been brought to you in part through the partnership with Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. For executive producer Russell Schubin, producers Charlie Richards and David Posehn, and Chanda Shizala, I'm Calvin McCullough. Join us next time for the Christian Outlook. When she was just a girl,
she expected the world. 3-star General Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.